In the coming week, Russia presses attacks in Ukraine as peace talks continue in Istanbul. The EU and China convene for a virtual trade summit, and Hungary holds a closely watched election. It's March 31st, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Matthias Matthes, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Matthias is a senior fellow for Europe at CFR and an associate professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. Matthias, we are featuring your continent today, and it's great to have you back on the show.
Excited to be back. Thanks, Bob. So let's kick off this week's show by talking about, of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So since last week, Bob, Russian and Ukrainian negotiators have met in Istanbul for peace talks, and Russia has announced it's actually scaling back its military activities near the Ukrainian capital city of Kyiv. Is this potentially good news then, or is it still too early to say?
Very much the latter, Matthias. And I would say, really, for the foreseeable future, any kind of reporting on these talks and talk of a breakthrough or ceasefire need to be taken with a large grain of salt or teaspoon of polonium, whatever you want to choose, because it's they're just not really credible at this point. And it's largely because I think Russia continues to use the talks as a bit of a sort of a trial balloon floating, perhaps a bit of a ruse. Let's just take the most recent example. There was a lot of excitement after there seemed to be progress with the Istanbul talks when they kicked off about prospects for a ceasefire, some areas of agreement, Russia talking about moving away from Kyiv and potentially, as announced by its defense ministry, focusing more on the Donbas. And then it proceeded to hammer Kyiv with one of its largest bombardments of the war, according to many people who were in the city at night, and a few other areas that have been pulverized recently as well. So very early to say what is possible. We're also hearing very kind of mixed signals coming out from just the foreign ministry itself of Russia about, you know, what was agreed on, what Ukraine agreed on, and so forth. Let me just go over quickly, Matthias, some of the things that they're talking about. There seems to be one area of breakthrough or one area of agreement is Ukraine declaring neutrality and what that could portend in terms of, you know, easing up Russian concerns of Ukraine being a sort of a NATO, you know, bulkhead right on Russia's border. There's a lot of other issues that's still involved there, but it does seem like Ukraine's ready to make such a declaration. But Russia is also insisting on demilitarization. And what that amounts to is a really sharp reduction in the size of Ukraine's military in a level that Ukraine would never agree to. It's safe to say they're talking about accepting the annexation of Crimea and either an independent statelet in the Donbas or accepting some sort of a separatism or pro-Russian entity in that region. And Ukraine has said repeatedly that that's not something it's going to accept, although Russian officials have said they've moved on that. So it's not clear. They also would like to have sanctions lifted, Russians would, as part of any agreement. Ukrainians, understandably, are looking for ceasefire. They're looking for a Russian movement out of Ukraine. And that seems pretty far off. So I guess it's good they're talking. It's good that they're talking in person at a very high level. And Turkey seems to be willing to be a broker or at the very least offering its good offices. But other than that, it's pretty early, Matthias.
It is interesting, though, how Russia seems to have scaled back its demands quite dramatically, right? From the very beginning of the military conflict in February 24, there's no longer talk about denazification. And I even think on the demand on demilitarization, they've scaled it back. It does seem to be the case that Ukraine is willing to commit to neutrality, right, giving up on NATO membership. But I'm kind of hoping, at least, that they can move from their claims, the Russian claims on the Donbas, to the kind of trade-off for territorial claims, which I don't think any Ukrainian government, let alone Zelensky's government, who seems to be incredibly popular and united now in their resistance, can ever give up territory officially, right? I mean, the goal seems to be to go back to the de facto borders on February 23rd, 2022. But then I guess, and I wonder what you think of this, is the US or is the West in a position to move on sanctions? That seems to be the big trade-off there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, we could talk about Zelensky a little bit. I mean, he's basically saying knuckle down further on sanctions and that this is how you're going to inflict pain, that you're going to get Russia to move, even though Russia's been, by many accounts, getting licked in its military actions in a and around Kyiv, and in a few other areas, certainly around Kharkiv in the east. Not so much in the south, although there are mixed reports about whether or not Ukrainian forces have retaken the city of Kherson in the south as well. So there's the military slog that Russia is facing, although it seems willing to face for a while. But there's the clear pain of the sanctions, and there has been seeming acknowledgement from that from Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Lavrov. So will the U.S. ease that? I think the U.S. is maintaining a very skeptical outlook right now. It wants to see clear, credible signs that Russia is going to, first of all, agree to a ceasefire. Just stop it. Stop shelling neighborhoods. Stop all the actions that it's doing right now to build some confidence and then kind of go from there. So there's a bit of that sequential aspect of confidence building that we hear so much about. Really big gestures need to happen, I think, Matthias, before you get any sort of movement on the sanctions front. But by everything I've seen, it's only ramping up further. The sanctions list is going further. You've seen European capitals this week also creating new lists of Russian diplomats that they are ousting for spying and other reasons. And so there continues to be this kind of ratcheting up of pressure on Russia.
But there's clearly been pressure on Putin to reorient the strategic objectives of this conflict, right? So the question is, since I don't see, I mean, there's kind of two scenarios I see going forward. One is where they really get bogged down in the Donbass, right? Which could be a long drawn out conflict where basically Russia puts everything on securing the full territory of Luhansk and Donetsk. So far, I think the line of contact hasn't moved that much from the kind of 33% of territory that they held since 2014. Or, you know, there's some sort of deal where Russia actually withdraws, declares neutrality its great victory, and gets sanctions relief slowly or gradually in return. But my question to you, Bob, is neutrality of Ukraine enough for Vladimir Putin to sell as a victory at home?
It's a really good question, and it's not clear. I mean, everybody thought they knew what Putin was capable of and what would be willing to do, and sort of all bets have been off since February 24th. And there's interesting reports coming out by the day, sometimes by the hour. I just saw prior to us taping this podcast late Wednesday that the U.S. intelligence has determined that there's this opening rift between the Russian military and the defense ministry in particular and Putin about what kind of information they're conveying to him and perhaps putting a rosier picture on what's going on in Ukraine. I also saw there was a very high U.S. State Department official giving a figure about Russian deaths passing 10,000 in the conflict, which is it's not as many as Ukrainians say have died, but it's a lot more than the Russians have admitted to, which is Russians have admitted to about 1,300 or 1,400 deaths. And certainly the scale of the Russian invasion, the scale of the fighting going on, and the real what we've seen is this kind of stasis in all these areas where they really wanted to move in and seize power would seem to indicate that that kind of thing is happening too, Matthias. So what kind of pressure can be brought to bear on Putin to sort of cut and run or cut and call it a day? I think one of the concerns also that I've been hearing more and more about is that Russia will try another page of its playbook. Putin and other Russians have tried this in most recent, let's say, post-Cold War decades, which is to create these frozen conflict zones. Okay, so they're not going to defeat the Ukrainians. They're not going to give up on seizing Kyiv and decapitating the government and so forth. But they keep a pretty sizable, potent force in the Donbas, for example, that they stay and they continue to pressure Mariupol, which is going through a hellish bombardment and circumstances right now, still something like 200,000 people trapped in that city. And by the way, that's becoming ever more important as this bridge that would connect Donbas, Russian forces in the Donbas to Crimea. So they would love to be able to claim that whole sort of ribbon of land and that whole connected area and declare victory from that. So I think that's something to watch further. But also, as we saw with the bombardment last night, they're not giving up on, you know, trying to create some pain in the capital as well.
Yeah. So to be continued, and hopefully for the Ukrainian people, Putin is more ready than we think right now to declare victory and leave, or at least make it into a frozen conflict with the end of hostilities.
Exactly. And the other thing that we continue to look at, there's so many subplots, but what sort of pressure or encouragement or assuasion could be brought to bear on the parties, especially Russia, from other countries? And China is one of those. And so this is the type of thing that one expects to hear in the European Union's virtual summit with China that starts on Friday, April 1st. It's there ostensibly to talk about trade, but also geopolitical tensions are going to be playing out. The meeting is widely seen as an effort to sort of ease the escalating tensions between the two sides. And we should note especially severe tensions between China and Lithuania, which has become a stalwart supporter of Taiwan. So, Matthias, can you give us a sense, set up what the summit's going to be like between the EU and China?
Absolutely. It's kind of amazing if you think about how far EU-China relations have come in the last, say, 16 months, right? So I think maybe for our listeners, it's useful to remember that in December 2020 was kind of the high moon, if you want, of EU-China relations. relations, right? This was near the end of Angela Merkel's days in office. She held the presidency of the European Union at the time with Germany, and they secured to great fanfare this comprehensive agreement on investment, the CAI with China, that wasn't universally praised among the EU members, especially, let's say, Lithuania, which we'll come back to, but was kind of not received that well in the United States, right?
Yep. That was one of the, big areas of angst facing the Biden administration, to put it mildly.
Absolutely, right? And the argument in Europe at the time was, listen, I mean, we can't wait for the Biden administration. We've kind of been hurt and traumatized, if you want, by 4 years of Donald Trump in office. And we're going to do what the US has done with China and cut bilateral deals, which is exactly what, you know, Merkel and Macron and so on sold this as. So that was December 2020, right? Then over the course of 2021, as the Biden administration gets into office and becomes serious about transatlantic relations and closer ties with the EU significantly cools on its relationship with China, right? I mean, they're really worried about...
Including Germany, right?
Including Germany, about human rights abuses in Xinjiang, treatment of Hong Kong, tensions with Taiwan that are increasing. And so they basically, the European Parliament decides to freeze this agreement, temporarily put it on the back burner. And in response, China had denied access to all kinds of members of the European Parliament, right? So by December 2021, we know what happened, right? I mean, the Russian troop buildup in Ukraine is serious. U.S. intelligence is right on this. And so that changed the original idea for the summit of April the 1st was a reset, right? After a very difficult year, the EU and China were going to, you know, basically start over, right? Forget about all the troubles and see which areas they could cooperate in. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine changed all that and complicated things, because now the official goal, as you mentioned, is really of EU officials, especially the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the Council President Charles Michel, the former Belgian Prime Minister, is to basically tell the Chinese, listen, you have leverage over Russia. You should be neutral in this conflict. You should respect the Western sanctions and not allow Russia to do business through the back door and basically avoid sanctions this way. And I expect this to be an incredibly difficult conversation, right? So first at 10 a.m. Brussels time on April 1st, it will be with the Prime Minister, Li Keqiang, and then at 2 p.m. Brussels time, it will be with the President, Xi Jinping. Even Mario Draghi, the Italian Prime Minister, last week's summit with where Joe Biden was a guest of honor, had said, you know, China has leverage. It's an important country. We are waiting to see what they can do to play a constructive role in this conflict. So the goal now has gone from looking at areas we can cooperate, climate change, trade, things like that, to can we ensure China's neutrality in this sanctions regime?
Matthias, I wonder what you think about, as I was listening to you discuss that, in the back of my mind was this narrative that's playing out now about, are we in a moment where if China is doubling down on support for Russia and the so-called West, you know, standing firm, that we're in a deglobalization moment, you know, because China has had strong ambitions to have its Belt and Road continue to play out through the lucrative ports of Europe. I believe that Italy has now gone very cool on its role in the Belt and Road, for example, although I think Greece, there's several ports in Greece that are owned by China. But is this a case where China is willing to sort of cut those ties for the principle of maintaining its cordial relationship with Russia and not wanting to, you know, sully that, even though it means a severe drop in business?
It's a very good question. To be honest, I don't regret not being Xi Jinping. I think he's in an incredibly difficult position for the simple reason that he just signed this big treaty of friendship with Russia, right? Very strong language directed against the transatlantic relationship, where basically the Chinese said, we agree with Russia that NATO is a threat to Russia's neighborhood, to its security order. They pretty much see this NATO alliance system in Europe the way the US has its alliance system in Asia with Japan, with Korea, and of course its guarantees with Taiwan. The Chinese very much experiences the way Russia experiences a NATO enlargement. And so the Chinese want to push back against this. That said, at the same time, you see this incredibly close transatlantic relationship, right? I mean, that's the one thing. If Putin achieved one thing invading Ukraine, is to make NATO cool again, right? I mean, NATO was brain dead, according to French President Emmanuel Macron about a year ago, right? Now nobody's talking in that manner anymore. And so you see the interests, I mean, EU, UK, US, Canada, and of course, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, what you could broadly call the West, right? With the exception of maybe Japan and Korea, even though they're part of the G7 and the G20 and things like that, that they are really the countries that are imposing the sanctions and respecting the sanctions. The rest of the world isn't. So in a sense, it's difficult for for Xi Jinping, right? Because his country economically relies on the West. He does not want to happen to his country what's just happened to Russia, right? So getting dragged into the Russian orbit, supporting Russia with arms, with economic aid and so on, which would then invite the wrath of the West. That's not a position they want to be in. On the other hand, they're very keen to point out that these are Western sanctions, right? This is not everybody against Russia, right? And so they point out India's neutrality, Brazil is not doing very much, and so on. But I don't disagree with you in the sense that what we potentially see here is that China will probably help Russia a little bit, but not too much either, right? So, and as in trying to avoid Western sanctions on its own economy, they don't want to see a huge humiliating defeat of the Russians either, because that would then be sold as a kind of big victory for the Western-led liberal order, something they want to push back on.
So this virtual summit they'll be talking to, or maybe sometimes at each other, are there any so-called deliverables we should expect to see from this?
Well, there is this case at the WTO. You mentioned Lithuania earlier on, right? That the EU started this case at the World Trade Organization against China, where they are accusing China of restrictive business practices against Lithuania and basically not respecting the free trading regime that any member of the WTO should. So that's a concrete thing that I think they will talk about, achieving at least some sort of Chinese cooperation with the Western sanctions without saying so out loud is a clear deliverable. But I think many other things that were going to be on the agenda that were kind of the trade and investment nature, how to cope with climate change, how to cooperate on renewables and so on, will probably not make it onto the agenda because, again, as we mentioned earlier, Ukraine seems to be taking up all the energy and time in those summits.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye out for how they manage this, but we could be seeing some sort of tense or terse statements in conclusion, then no communique maybe.
Absolutely. And I think that is the result also of, I mean, very tactful, very smart diplomacy by the Americans, by the Biden administration, which now has made the Europeans realize that the transatlantic reliance really is in this jointly together, right? So this pivot to Asia that started under the Obama administration is now clearly seen as a transatlantic pivot to Asia, where they will jointly deal with Chinese challenges and at the same time trying to keep the sanctions regime with Russia going.
Got it. Well, there's an election that was long planned that is suddenly taking on a more dramatic cast with the events in Ukraine, and that is the general elections in Hungary this Sunday, April 3rd. Hungarians are going to be heading to the polls, and it's the first time since Viktor Orban has taken power in his 2010 election that he's facing a united front of opposition parties. Now, Orban is famously the self-styled illiberal Democrat, and his Fidesz party has really dominated, and they've done a lot to consolidate their gains, whether it's dominating the courts or media or so forth. They are seen by other populists in the West as a model of sorts. But Matthias, are we going to see something that potentially a sea change in Hungary?
Yeah, that would be the hope of many, right? I would be a little more pessimistic when it comes to this outcome. You're absolutely right. In the absence of any Russian invasion in Ukraine, this would have probably been the event of the spring, together with the French presidential elections that are happening a week later, at least the first round. But so Sunday, April 3rd is significant because these elections are very closely watched in Europe and for that matter around the world because of the nature of the Hungarian regime that has gradually slid from a kind of flourishing democracy in 2010 when Orban was elected, not for the first time. He'd been prime minister already in the late 1990s for 2 years, but a very different Orban was elected in 2010 as he kind of set out to systematically hollow out the rule of law, the independent media, and any kind of democratic principle that, you know, the European Union at least holds dear. Of course, was re-elected in 2014, was re-elected in 2018, and always with super majorities, right? So the genius, if you want, the autocratic genius of Orban has been that he's done everything by the book. He's never broken any laws. He's changed the laws according to the book and created this kind of super majority for his Fidesz party.
And claimed popular support in the process.
And popular support has built up and he's been quite successful, right? I mean, using EU money and attracting foreign direct investment and so on, right? But it has gone at the cost of significant emigration, right? A lot of young Hungarians have left, and the European Union single market has made that possible thanks to the free movement of labor. But he's also received significant subsidies from the European Union that he's used to prop up his own regime. And so these things have been deeply problematic. You're right. This is an interesting election, more than the others, because there is a united opposition. But it's also not without its problems. So there's this guy guy called Peter Markizet. He's not some leftist, right? He is in the end a Christian conservative, the father of seven children that has won this kind of, you know, big time primary of like six or seven opposition parties that span from like old communists, modern socialists, social democrats to actually Jobbik, who's further to the right of Orban's Fidesz. So it's a very unnatural coalition with the only one thing that's uniting them. It is probably the only way that they can come to power, or they can at least oust Viktor Orban. And so in October of 2021, there was a kind of precedent there in the Czech Republic. Andrej Babiš, a similar type Orban-style leader, of course, he had a minority government. He'd only been in power for one term, but he was defeated by a united opposition of about five parties. And Peter Markizet was pointing to this October 21 moment in Prague. I was like, listen, if this can happen in Prague, it can happen in Budapest in April 2022. So here again, the war in Ukraine, the Russian aggression in Ukraine has shifted in the later stages of the campaign, the whole dynamics of this Hungarian election. And let me tell you how. You would expect Viktor Orban, who's very chummy, who's very close with Vladimir Putin, to be punished by this. That's what we're seeing in France. All Macron's opponents had very close ties with Russia. They're all being punished, with the exception of Marine Le Pen. But that's for another podcast. So if we look at Orban, he very cleverly reframed the debate. So what did Peter Markizet say at the very beginning of this debate? It's either you're with Putin and Orban, that's one choice, or you're with us and the West, that's the other choice. Orban immediately reframed this, and given that he controls all of the media, there's almost no independent media left in Hungary, he said, no, that's not the choice. The choice is either for peace, and I'm working for peace because of my close ties with Vladimir Putin, or you're voting for war. If you're supporting the opposition, they want to get involved in this military conflict, they want NATO to step up, and so on. And so they basically want to escalate this conflict. I want to de-escalate this conflict. And what we've seen, as much as we can trust public opinion polls of the upcoming election, from a neck and neck race between United for Hungary and Fidesz, now Fidesz has kind of taken a 5% lead. So the rally around the flag effect in a moment of national security crisis has clearly benefited Orban.
That's very interesting. I mean, there was another interesting wrinkle that caused Orban to pivot, but maybe it's a sign of his deftness, which was unlike in, say, 2015, the migration crisis then. Hungary, as a bordering country, has allowed Ukrainians to come in. Not in the numbers that Poland has, but it has accepted Ukrainians. Is that mollifying some sense of the population that might have a humanitarian feeling about this and maybe sees Orban as reasonable in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, Orban has of course, had to walk a very fine line, right? I mean, he cannot openly say, we don't want Syrian refugees, but we do want nice white Christian refugees from Ukraine, even though that's exactly what it comes down to in its essence, right? He hasn't been as enthusiastic as Poland, right? The ties between Poland and Ukraine are a lot closer. But yeah, he has received them with open arms, if you want. He's been very positive about it. And the Hungarian people, right, as well, have seen this as a sign that, you know, it's not just black and white for Viktor Orban either. But after all, I mean, they are Orthodox Christians. He is supposedly very much a defender of a Christian Hungary and so on. And so it's fit into his general view of how to deal with this crisis. But at the same time, he's been very careful not to allow lethal weaponry pass through the Hungarian-Ukrainian border, right? So most of that transfer has happened through the Polish-Ukrainian border. Again, with the argument that then these become targets, right? And then the war could spread to the east of Hungary, which is something that's in nobody's interest. He's also kept up, I think, his kind of EU criticism, right? So what's happened there is that so many people in Europe are waiting for the European Commission to punish Hungary for all its anti-democratic practices by cutting them off from funding and so on, because they now need Hungary in the sanctioned regime and they need them to keep the pressure up on Putin's Russia. Orban has actually been the benefactor of this, right? I mean, they have managed to kind of keep the aid flowing, and he's abused this and immediately said, if they don't do this, it's again because the EU is anti-Hungarian and so on, and they don't respect us as our sovereign choices and things like that.
All right, so we'll keep a lookout this weekend for an early electoral Ukraine test, I guess, for Eastern Europe.
Yeah, well, Bob, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_ORG. This week, Bob, our audience selected Sudan military crackdown. Why did our audience select this figure?
It's an interesting question, Matthias. I would think that it's related to, while there's been a military crackdown taking place for a number of months now since the coup back in October, October, you had a UN envoy for Sudan warning just this week that the country was heading for what he called, quote, an economic and security collapse, end quote, unless it took steps to address vigorously the kind of paralysis that has set in on the country. Now, this is a UN envoy of Volker Perthes, and he basically said that, you know, that there's big time repression going on, protests. There's, we should say that the Sudanese people, ever since the ouster of Bashir, Omar Bashir, the leader accused of genocide and who was ousted in 2019, there has been democratic stirrings in the country and a real sense of and real courage among Sudanese to press for the civilian role in leading the country. And they thought they were on that path until the coup. So now we have a coup. We don't have any sort of political agreement or any sort of a pact that the country can rely on to then, you know, move forward. We're looking at potentially a kind of Egypt style consolidation of power behind the military leadership, but it's happening so far in a very a combination of kind of sloppy but also repressive way. The country stood to gain some aid, especially from the U.S. if it, you know, took a path of agreeing to brokering a military transition, a democratic transition. It seems to not want to take that path anymore, and so the aid route seems to have dried up at a time when the country can ill afford that. East Africa, we should note, we've published a number of reports on our website. Our colleague Michelle Gavin has been warning about this. The region is in a really bad way. It's in a really bad way ecologically. It's in a really bad way in terms of population flight because of other problems involving wars, Ethiopia being a big one. And also the region relies heavily on Ukraine and Russia for its wheat supplies, its grain supplies. And so all of those things are coming together now and really challenging the region at a time when repression is sort of hardening. And what had been seen as this real beacon potentially for a democratic transition is looking really, really like it's just going to go the way we've seen in Sudan and other countries more recently.
If only we could have ended on a more optimistic note. That's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. We'll have the anniversary of the foundation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that will be marked. NATO is cool again. The Muslim month of Ramadan begins, and the United Kingdom takes over the presidency of the United Nations Security Council.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Any articles, books, or podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatt, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Matias Mateus saying goodbye.
Thanks again, Matias, and this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.